This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
In this edition today, our bulletin of church news to be followed by Panorama, and then our feature of culture and society. Today we shall close with a segment dedicated to young people. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Pope Leo XIV has expressed his condolences and solidarity for the victims of an Air India flight that crashed on Thursday, just minutes after takeoff in the Indian city of Ahmedabad. The plane was bound for London with 242 people on board and reportedly crashed on top of the dining area of state-run BJ Medical College Hostel, killing many medical students as well. In a telegram to the Indian authorities, the Pope said he was deeply saddened by the tragedy and prayed for the victims. Devin Watkins has this report.
Air India Flight 171 took off from Ahmedabad Airport on Thursday with 242 people aboard, bound for London Gatwick Airport. The Boeing 787 Dreamliner crashed into a residential area near the airport soon after takeoff, reportedly into the state-run BJ Medical College Hostel, a residence for doctors. Pope Leo XIV sent a message on Thursday to express his heartfelt condolences to the families and friends of those who lost their lives in the crash. In a telegram signed by Cardinal Secretary of State Pietro Parolin, the Pope said he was deeply saddened by the tragedy involving an Air India aircraft near Ahmedabad. Pope Leo assured everyone affected of his prayers for those involved in the recovery efforts and commended the souls of the deceased to the mercy of the Almighty. The Air India plane was carrying 169 Indians, 53 Britons, 7 Portuguese, and 1 Canadian. Passengers included 217 adults, 11 children, and 2 infants, according to Reuters news agency. Images shared on social media and local television channels showed smoke billowing from the crash site as well as debris on fire. Rescue workers appeared at the scene shortly after the crash, and video showed stretchers transporting the injured. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi called the crash heartbreaking beyond words. He said the tragedy in Ahmedabad has stunned and saddened us, expressing his closeness to everyone affected by the crash. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said in a statement that the incident was devastating. Britain enjoys close ties with India, and nearly 1.9 million people of Indian descent live in the country, according to the 2021 UK Census. I'm Devin Watkins.
Earlier on Thursday morning, Pope Leo XIV welcomed to the Vatican all priests assigned to work in the Archdiocese of Rome. The encounter took place in the Vatican's Paul VI Hall and was the first official meeting since his election on 8th May of the Bishop of Rome with priests working in his Archdiocese, who also included deacons and seminarians. Deborah Lubav reports.
Siete tutti preziosi agli occhi di Dio e nella realizzazione del suo progetto.
You are all precious in the eyes of God and in the realization of his plan. Pope Leo XIV gave this reminder when receiving all priests of the Diocese of Rome in the Vatican Thursday morning. The Lord, he said, knows well when priests are only united to him, and that when united among ourselves, we can bear fruit and give the world a credible witness. The Pope reassured, I would like to help you, to walk with you, so that each one may regain serenity in their ministry. But precisely for this, he called for renewed effort in priestly fraternity, which he stressed is rooted in a solid spiritual life, in an encounter with the Lord, and in listening to his word. After discussing the need for unity and communion, he called for being exemplary. The Pope recalled that when he ordained priests on the 31st of May, he had underscored how important it is to have transparent lives. Thus, Pope Leo urged, "I ask you this with the heart of a father and of a pastor. Let us all commit to being credible and exemplary priests." He said, "Let yourselves be drawn once more by the call of the Master to feel and live the love of the first hour, the one that led you to make strong choices and courageous renunciations.
Lasciatevi ancora attrarre dalle chiamate del Maestro."
If together, he said, we strive to be exemplary in a humble life, then we will be able to express the renewing power of the gospel for every man and woman. The Pope called on them to embrace challenges as opportunities for witness, urging, "Let us not run away from them." Pope Leo reiterated, "I assure you of my closeness, affection, and willingness to walk with you." With this sentiment, the Holy Father concluded praying, "Priests may be accompanied by the following appeal of St. Augustine, who said, 'Love this church, remain in this church, be this church,' and also said to love the Good Shepherd and also to pray for the scattered sheep, that they too may come.
Amate questa chiesa, restate in questa chiesa, siate questa chiesa. Amate il buon pastore, lo sposo bellissimo, che non inganna nessuno e non vuole che alcuno perisca."
I'm Deborah Castellano-Lubov.
Pope Leo XIV has expressed his gratitude to the King and Queen of Spain for having made an effort to come to the Vatican to attend his installation mass and the ceremony to mark the beginning of his pontificate on May 18th. The Holy Father's words of thanks came in a phone conversation that he had on Wednesday afternoon with the Prime Minister of Spain, Pedro Sanchez Perez Castellón. Chaos Gassi has this report.
On the afternoon of June 11, Pope Leo XIV spoke on the phone with Mr. Pedro Sanchez Perez Castellón, Prime Minister of Spain. The Holy See Press Office released a statement explaining that during the call, the Pope expressed his gratitude that King Felipe and Queen Letizia came to Rome to participate in the Mass, marking the beginning of his Petrine ministry. The two also discussed topics important to both countries, including the migration crisis, the need to build bridges to resolve ongoing conflicts, and the defense of human dignity. Prime Minister Sanchez Perez Castellón also renewed his invitation for Pope Leo to visit Spain after they commented on the upcoming 4th International Conference on Financing for Development, set to take place in June in Seville, Spain. I'm Kelsey Gussie.
The Vatican Bank, also known as the Institute for the Works of Religion, known by its acronym as IOR, on Wednesday published its annual report. This organization is the only entity authorized to professionally carry out financial activities in the Vatican City State. Its report also includes a dividend of 13.8 million euros for the Pope, which is in line with the mission of the Institute to support religious and charitable works. You are tuned to the Daily Africa service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
Judges at the European Court of Human Rights have ruled in favor of Italy in a case brought by a group of migrants rescued from the Mediterranean Sea in a fatal boat sinking in 2017. The judges of the court based in Strasbourg, France, ruled on Thursday that Italy could not be held liable for the actions of the Libyan Coast Guard and declared the case inadmissible. The court found that Italy did not have effective control of the expanse of waters off the coast of Tripoli, where a small ship carrying some 150 people sank in 2017. 20 people died in the incident. Around 45 survivors on board the ship said they were taken to Tanjoura Detention Center in the Libyan capital Tripoli, where they were beaten and abused. Italy had supplied the Libyans with funding, vessels and the training as part of an agreement to slow the tide of migrants crossing the Mediterranean. The judges found, however, that this support did not prove Italy had taken over Libya's public authority powers. The Associated Press reported that a ruling in favor of the 14 survivors who had filed a complaint at the ECHR could have undermined international agreements made by several European Union countries with Libya, Turkey and others to prevent migrants from coming to European shores. Burundi's ruling party has won all 100 seats contested in the country's legislative elections, according to results released by the National Electoral Commission on Wednesday. The sweeping victory has sparked outrage from opposition parties who have denounced the polls as fraudulent and undemocratic. In a statement Thursday, the rights group Human Rights Watch said that the June 5th legislative and local elections took place in a context of severely restricted free speech and political space. The National Council for the Defense of Democracy, Forces for the Defense of Democracy, abbreviated as CNDD-FDD, which has been in power since 2005, secured 96.51% of the vote, while all other parties failed to meet the 2% threshold required for parliamentary representation. The death toll in floods in South Africa's Eastern Cape province has risen to 57, a government minister visiting the scene of the disaster said on Thursday. The floods hit the Eastern Cape province early on Tuesday after an extreme cold front brought heavy rain, strong winds and snow to parts of Eastern and Southern Africa. The floods centered on the town of Mtata and its surrounding district, which is around 430 kilometers south of the east coast city of Durban. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
This is Culture and Society, and welcome to the program. My name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Pax Christi International is a Catholic peace movement whose mission is to transform a world shaken by violence, terrorism, deepening inequality and global insecurity. Pax Christi recently created the Catholic Institute for Nonviolence with the objective of making nonviolence research, resources and experience more accessible to Catholic Church leaders, communities and institutions in order to deepen Catholic understanding of and commitment to the practice of the gospel nonviolence. Marie Denise, who once served as co-president of Pax Christi International from 2007 to 2019, is currently the senior program director of the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative. She spoke to Vatican Radio's Chaos Gassi about what motivated Pax Christi to create this section of the organization.
Pax Christi has, since it was founded 80 years ago, has had a long, deep commitment to nonviolence. It was practiced in different ways in different parts of the world. We work on every continent and have maybe 100 and something member organizations. After the turn of the millennium, we began to collect from members around the world stories about why they used nonviolence. Was it because of their faith? Was it because they knew nonviolence would work? Was it because it was the only choice? And we, after we collected those stories for a while, we asked the Vatican if that was then the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace would co-sponsor with us a small conference to hear more stories from parts of the world where violence was very intense, war zones all over the world. And we did co-sponsor that conference with the Pontifical Council. And from that conference came a program called the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative, because what we heard from people who came from everywhere, from Sri Lanka to Afghanistan and Sudan and Colombia and Guatemala and all over the world, was nonviolence is the only way forward, that we have to learn how to deal with conflict without violence. And so we started the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative then in about 2016 with the goal of helping to move nonviolence more to the center of Catholic teaching and understanding and practice. And after several years of that, as we began to see how what good research there is now on the effectiveness of nonviolent strategies, the importance of addressing the root causes of violence and so on, we wanted to find a way to make that research and experience a little bit more accessible to church leaders. We've always thought of the church as, of course, the Vatican and Vatican offices, but also the local church. So bishops, bishops' conferences, religious congregations, universities, and so on. And it seemed that having an institute where we could bring together the best research, the best reflection on gospel nonviolence, bringing theologians and scripture scholars and so on together with the best social science research being done on what we call strategic nonviolence, practices of nonviolence that can actually interrupt, prevent, or deal with violence, and case studies that we – the goal of the institute would be to make that conversation between experience, social sciences, and theology available, accessible to the church. So that's why we started the institute.
And in this research and the work that the Catholic Institute for Nonviolence is doing, I'm sure the topic of nonviolence versus pacifism has come about. What would you describe the difference between those two?
That's a great question because, yes, we have tended to say that we do not equate pacifism and nonviolence. Obviously, they're related. I think of pacifism as an inspiring personal ethic to which a person or a community can commit themselves. We think of nonviolence as, yes, a commitment to not use violence, but also a full engagement in addressing conflict in an effective way. And we would say that nonviolence is hopefully effective, appropriate most of the time, but there until we get to a place where we actually understand how nonviolence can work all the time, there may be some occasions to protect vulnerable communities and so on. There might be a need for some inter-violence in the short term, always with the goal of eliminating violence, of finding other ways to deal with conflict.
And in recent years, because we do see, especially now, the world, I mean, I'm sure it's always been this case, but now with media, we know a lot more of the wars that are happening, violence that's happening all around the world. Catholic social teaching and the idea of that with peace, how has that really shifted, or how have you seen through the research, have you seen that change?
We've seen a really significant change that obviously began in the early 20th century, but up until the maybe 1980s, when we saw one revolution after another that was nonviolent be successful. The classics in, well, obviously in India, but also in the Philippines, in Poland and Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union and on and on and on. We began to see that church teaching, which the just war tradition always insisted that violence was a last resort. But it also there was a tendency to for the teaching to say those teaching the just war tradition to say that nonviolence was a personal choice, that it wasn't, it didn't look like it was going to be appropriate for example, for a government that was charged with protecting the people living in a particular part of the world. We began to see that shift. In fact, during what is called the third democratic wave in the 1980s, we began the 80s thinking the world was just in a terrible place with dictatorships all over the place. By the end of the 80s, we saw a real shift. And the Catholic Church was actually – has been identified as one of three or four main of the sort of ways and reasons why that shift happened, because the Church began to teach nonviolence, began to support nonviolent movements, began to see the connection between the gospel and nonviolence. But still, in the 80s, there was still a tendency to say nonviolence is for individuals, to make that commitment. Governments probably will need to really rely on the just war tradition. I think in the last 15 years, that has really shifted. We see that nonviolence more and more is moving to the center of Catholic teaching on violence and war. And, of course, we're not only talking about war when we talk about nonviolence. It's a response to a way of dealing with conflict at an interpersonal level all the way to open war. But I think there has been a significant shift in Catholic teaching, even in 15 years, when we would talk about nonviolence in the early 2000s, for example, there was a tendency for leaders to kind of pat us on the head and say, that's really nice, but it's not very realistic. It's kind of idealistic. And that is just not the case anymore. There's been the classic research that was done in 2010, I think.
Senior Program Director of the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative, Marie Denise, talking there to Vatican Radio's Kelsey Garcy about what motivated Pax Christi to create the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative. And that is all we have time for in this edition of Culture and Society. Until next week, at the same time, my name is Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba.
And now, news for young people.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali. This Thursday, June the 12th, is observed as World Day Against Child Labour. This year's theme is Progress is Clear, but there is more to do. Let's speed up efforts. Child labour is the employment of children in an industry, business or farm, especially when illegal or considered exploitative. The International Labour Organization has also described child labour as any work performed by a child which deprives them of their childhood, their potential and their dignity, and that is harmful to their physical and mental development. The day is observed annually to raise global awareness and mobilise action to end the scourge. Nearly 138 million children were engaged in child labour in 2024, including around 54 million in hazardous work likely to jeopardize their health, safety or development, according to new estimates released on Wednesday by the International Labour Organization and the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF. The report titled Child Labour Global Estimates 2024, Trends and the Road Forward said the world has missed its target of eliminating child labour by the year 2025. Daniel Johnson of UN News tells us more.
The world's nations made a pledge to end child labour by this year, and yet 138 million youngsters still work today, UN agencies said on Wednesday. According to new data from the International Labour Organization ILO and the UN Children's Fund UNICEF, 12 million fewer children are involved in child labour now than in 2020. Progress is possible, but we must not be blindsided by the fact that we still have a long way to go, said ILO Director General Gilbert Hungbo. Echoing that message, UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell warned that far too many children continue to toil in mines, factories or fields. Often they have to do hazardous work to survive, Ms. Russell added, a reference to the 54 million youngsters who toil in unsafe conditions. In Madagascar, 12-year-old Tenasoa, who is partially paralysed by polio, crawls to work at a mine where she collects 2 kilos of the shiny mineral mica each day. It's used in the paint and cosmetics industry to add shimmer. If we don't work, we don't eat, Tenasoa's grandfather told UNICEF. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
On February 3rd this year, the Vatican held its first ever international summit on children's rights in the Apostolic Palace with the presence of the late Pope Francis. Addressing participants, the late Pope emphasized that nothing is worth more than the life of a child and that all children deserve to be protected and loved. He urged world leaders to listen to the suffering of children, especially those impacted by war, poverty and migration. He also highlighted the plight of undocumented children and the need for greater international collaboration to ensure a future free from abuse. In his address at the summit in the Vatican, Philip Van Hooyinghem, the head of the Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work branch of the International Labour Organization, urged governments and their partners to act to eliminate child labour. He began by sharing on his encounter with a child labourer at a mine in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Children's rights are under pressure as never in recent times. 1 month ago, I had the privilege to visit one of our projects in a mine in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I met Jean-François, a 15-year-old boy who collects cobalt, who is so important for this critical device. There is today 160 million children like Jean-François in child labor. Half are in what we define hazardous work. 70% work in small-scale farming and small-scale mining. This figure comes from the ILO and UNICEF. This is a brutal and cruel injustice, and we just cannot be indifferent, as it was rightly said this morning. It is a question of living up to commitment the world has made to children. And the political will exists. 26 years ago, the ILO adopted the Convention 182 on the worst forms of child labour. In 2020, it became the very first ILO convention to reach universal ratification. It requires immediate and effective action to end abuse such as slavery, debt bondage, the use of children in armed conflict, commercial sexual exploitation of children, and hazardous work that put their health, safety, and even their lives in jeopardy.
That was Philip Van Hooningham, head of the Fundamental Principles and Rights at Work branch of the International Labour Organization, speaking during the first ever World Leaders Summit on Child Rights held in the Vatican. The February 3rd summit was convened by the late Pope Francis. And that's all for this edition of News for Young People. Till the same time next week, I am Festus Tarawali. So this one's for all the lost children. This one's for all the lost children. This one's for all the lost children. Wishing them well and wishing them home.
This is the Africa Service of Vatican Radio, and I am Kanyanta Godfrey Kampamba. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.